Welcome back to the FDH Lounge, only on the Sports Talk Network. Rick Morris and Elaine Tanko, your FDH Lounge dignitaries. And clearly, we're going to have one more name to add to that list the next time we update our guest list for a promo. This next gentleman here, I alluded to this prior to the break. The FDH New York Bureau, Steve Cervillo, our senior producer, I refer to him as our black belt networker. We expect certain things to happen when he goes places. He's always going to events. He's always meeting people in different places here. You don't expect just a chance encounter on the streets of NYC to end up with something here and something useful for the show, but that's exactly how it played out last week. I believe it was Friday. And in the course of this, you find out a little bit of something about the individual behind the name here, because this gentleman who's coming on with us here has really proven to be a gentleman in accepting our invitation and wanting to come on here and discuss his projects. He's got some really fascinating ones going on here, and his people have really been kind enough to help us in our prep. And we really appreciate that here as far as a little bit of guidance on what are the best things to talk about here tonight. I alluded to that again before the break. This looks like it might be the busiest and most interesting time for him since he had a couple of these breakthrough projects back in the 80s, one being Vision Quest, which, by the way, that was a movie that was referenced. Our good buddy Ray Dittinger, Philadelphia sports writer, in his book of the top 100 sports movies of all time. He and Glenn McNow had that book. We discussed it on the program. That movie was in the book. Of course, the other breakthrough movie in the 80s that really catapulted him, Full Metal Jacket, and he's got a fascinating project surrounding that now, and I think that's probably about where we're going to start tonight. I speak, of course, of actor-director Matthew Modine. Matthew, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the FDH Lounge. Sir, how are you this evening?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Rick.
It's so great to have you in.
On the streets in New York City.
Yeah, how about that? And we really appreciate that, because I'll tell you what, I mean, not everybody is as nice as you were. Sometimes, people at a certain stature will big time you, and you didn't. So as I say, we learned right off the bat that you're a gentleman, sir.
Well, I think that Steve is a real gentleman himself. I mean, he approached me. He seemed legitimate, and he talked about the show. I did my due diligence. I found out about your show, and here I am.
Well, it's great to have you in here, and of course, your due diligence would have yielded very quickly the notion that nothing is off topic here. We talk about anything and everything. I'll put the scope up against anybody's, and that's what we love talking about people or with people who really have a lot of things going on. You most certainly do. Let's start with this Full Metal Jacket Diary project here. What a great way to expand beyond the book that you came out with a couple of years ago here and really build on those experiences. Talk about this this iPad app that is being created right now through Kickstarter, because that has to just be a hugely exciting project for you.
Yeah, a good friend of mine, Adam Rakoff, he used to work for Apple Computers, and he's just a genius. He's a really, really bright guy, and he asked me about if I'd be interested in turning my book, Full Metal Jacket Diary, into an app. And I said, well, how would you do that? And he explained it and how he really wanted to take, because the book was only, it was limited to 20,000 copies. I wanted to make a piece of art. You know, each book has a serial number on it, and the book sold out very quickly. So he said that he'd like to create an opportunity for people to experience the book in a completely new way, where it would be not just a flip book, but a book where it would be filled with sound effects and music, and for people to have the ability to zoom into the photographs that I took with a Rolleiflex camera. So the resolution on the photographs is incredible, and you'd be able to really look into details of the filming process that was extraordinary, you know, just having the opportunity to work with Stanley Kubrick. But for Stanley to give me the opportunity to have photographed on his set is just an opportunity for people to look at Stanley's work in a way that's never been done before. So he started building this app, and it's quite expensive, and he's not a wealthy guy, and so he's been using Kickstarter as an opportunity to. I gave him a bunch of photographs and memorabilia from the film, so that he could. I just gave it to him so he can use that money from selling, you know, from pledges, they call it, on Kickstarter, from So if you pledge $5, you can have your name in the special thanks on the back of the on the application. You could actually have your name in the credits for just $5, and for $20 you can get the first downloads of the app when it comes out, and then there's photographs that were printed for the book back in 19 well printed when I say that when I mean in 1985 when I was making the film. I made presents for people that were working on the film, Adam Baldwin or Stanley Kubrick or et cetera, Arlie Ermey, the drill instructor in the film, and I gave those photographs away as gifts. And when you get a print made, you often they'll give you 3 prints, so you can pick the resolution of the, if you want a little bit darker, a little bit lighter. And I gave them prints from back in 1985, and these are the 2 prints that are left over from those gifts that I made to the actors and to Stanley Kubrick. And those will be available to people who pledge on Kickstarter.
It is really amazing. We have links up here, by the way, tonight on our rundown at Kickstarter.com, specifically the link to this project, as well as FullMetalJacketDiary.com, where people can track this as well as MatthewModine.com. We have links to all of these things up here tonight, and we'll continue to mention these are available there. That is very cool that people can participate, again, in terms of even via a small pledge. What I kind of liken that to is maybe like when you go to the ballpark and you see the bricks there. I know a Progressive Field in Cleveland, you see bricks from people who, I don't remember if it was from PSLs or whatever the case it was, but the chance to be a permanent part of something like this, to get your name in the credits for this kind of a project, if you're that big of a fan that you're going to want to participate in this way, to have it attached forever has just got to be really breathtaking.
Well, that's a perfect example, Rick. That's a really good example. And let's say you had a friend or a brother that was a United States Marine. What a great gift for $5 that you could put their name in the app credits. They'd be a part of this thing forever.
And as far as the iPad app itself, and I realize that I'm probably about 20 generations behind in terms of the technology and thinking of it this way, but the way I was kind of conceptualizing it in my mind, that this would be a much more primitive version, was almost sort of like a CD-ROM, the way that people think of those things here, where you can read, but as you say, there's the other visual elements that kind of jump out at you and some sound also. It sounds like this would be just about the most finely tuned version possible of the way that people think of a CD-ROM.
Yes, and the technology just keeps evolving, and that's one of the exciting things about applications is those people who have them on their phones and stuff like that, you often see that there's an update that's available for your app. And so for time and eternity, we might be able to continue to have the app evolve, collecting photographs from other people that worked on the film, different conversations and interviews. Because a book, when you make a book, you don't want to write a 1,000-page book if you can do it in 300 pages. And the thing about the app is that this can really be something that continues to evolve over time. Speaking with other people that worked on the film, with crew members that worked on the film, giving people the opportunity to hear from, let's say, a person who was in the prop department. How was it working with Stanley Kubrick different than working with all those other directors that you've worked with? So it's very exciting to see what Adam's going to be able to do and how this application is going to evolve as he continues to build it.
One of the things that also had occurred to me, Matthew, is that when you look at the legacy of the film, and I understand when you said you did the book that you wanted it to be something that would have been at a level that Stanley would have been proud of, and certainly a project like this as well, but it seems like that the movie, which was very important to your own legacy as far as helping really to take you up to that scale that you reached, and the movie being as important as it was in the history of cinema, this really adds substantially to the legacy of it, because as you're pointing out, this type of project, I mean, there's not really a direct precedent for it that I can think of as far as a celebration of it, as far as something that really adds to people's lasting appreciation of it, ability to participate in seeing what really happened behind the scenes and how it came together. This is something where when people think of Full Metal Jacket in the decades to come, they're as likely to think about something like this and the role that it may have played in spawning other imitators as they will maybe the film itself.
Yeah, and that's just a testament to Stanley Kubrick's genius as a filmmaker. The film continues to have relevance today, and like most of Stanley Kubrick's films, that over time they continue to get better and better. I mean, I recently was on an airplane and they had 2001: A Space Odyssey on, and I watched it, and I felt as though it was the first time I've seen it, and I know that I've seen it probably 5 or 6 times since it came out, and I'm a different person, obviously, than I was, let's say I saw it 5 years ago, than I was 5 years ago, and so it means something different, and I remember Stanley saying something when we were making Full Metal Jacket, and we were together for almost 2 years. He said that a film should be like a great piece of music, that something that you can listen to over and over again, and it should always be something that's interesting, and hopefully that it's a different experience, and you hear things in the music that you didn't hear on previous listenings, you know, so the film should be something like that. And it was something that was really Stanley's gift with his film. I remember when The Shining came out, there was a lot of people who were dismissive of it, saying that it wasn't his best work. And over time, The Shining has become, you know, one of those unbelievable classic horror films. And I know there are images in the film that when they're coming up with those two twins, standing in the hallway, or when he embraces that woman and she becomes a corpse, or the elevator doors opening and the blood spilling out, that there's just horrible, terrifying images that continue to haunt you when you watch that film. And for a lot of people, when they watch Full Metal Jacket, it continues to be an extraordinary experience. Stanley Kubrick's favorite review of the film, he said, was the first half of the film, that part with Lee Ermey and the drill, in boot camp. He says the first half of the film is brilliant. Then the film degenerates into a masterpiece. And he called me. He said that's good writing. And I think he's right. I think that the film has become kind of an interesting, peculiar masterpiece.
It has, and definitely, no question about it. This app is really going to do it proud. And again, I can say that I don't have an iPad yet, but this is definitely going to be very high on my to-do list when I get one, because I'm definitely going to want to see this and look at things in the different perspective. And speaking of perspectives here, I have to ask you what this was like, because you've been immersed in something here. It's just going to be hitting the screen on HBO, this Too Big to Fail movie based on the Andrew Sorkin book about the collapse on Wall Street in 2008. I mean, we're really still in that era, it seems like. We haven't had all of the fallout, all the manifestations of this go, not least of which because the economy is still down from that point in time, and there's no guarantee that it's not going to get very bad again. So everything is basically attributable to where we started there. So for something like this, where there's really not a lot of historical distance, really distance of any sort, what was it like for you taking on this role, playing the Merrill Lynch CEO in the movie, and portraying it in this period of the immediacy?
Yeah, this is only the second HBO film that I've been involved in. The first one was And the Band Played On, which is about the search and discovery of the AIDS virus, and was obviously, when we made that film, that was a very topical subject as well. So it's really wonderful to be coming back to HBO and working on such an important project that's trying to look at and put things into historic perspective. And it almost right on the tail, of it having happened, like you say. It's very difficult to understand. I mean, finance was never one of my strong suits, nor was math. And when we think of things in billions and trillions of dollars of money that was lost, that was misplaced, that disappeared, it's unfathomable, the chaos of what was happening in the financial business in America, and has been over the last few years. It's very difficult for me to understand. But if I think of things, my father was a drive-in theater manager. At one point, he decided he wanted to get in the restaurant business. And the thing about, if I just think about business in America, small businesses in America, if you and I, let's say you and I, Rick, we opened up a restaurant, and we didn't manage the restaurant well. We didn't serve a good product, and people didn't come, and we couldn't pay our bills. We'd go out of business. Nobody would come and bail us out. And I think that that's the sort of backbone of free trade and capitalism and the way it's supposed to function. This idea of bailing the financial system out because it was too big to fail. I don't understand it. I'm sure that there's some great people who might call in right now and tell me why I'm wrong to think that it was too big to fail. But I don't understand it. Just from the perspective of, let's say, you know, our restaurant that we opened, that we didn't do a good job and went out of business.
Yeah, these things are very tough to wrap your mind around, and particularly with some of the sickening misconduct that took place and led up to it. I mean, I guess that leads rather directly into the next question here as far as portraying John Thayne, the former chairman and CEO of Merrill Lynch, and I understand that's your role in this movie is coming out. Great cast, by the way, from everything that I've read about this. Unbelievable cast. HBO did very, very well and assembling this here. Is it necessary for you to work to find at least a tiny bit of empathy for this guy in order to portray him properly, or is it a thing where sometimes you just go with it and okay, you know, this guy really is the mustache twirling villain, and you know, there's not really much that I can do to kind of shade it another way? How do you approach a character like this, a guy who apparently did such harm to so many?
Yeah, I think probably most bad people don't think that they're doing bad things. You know, does a sociopath feel like they're a bad guy, or they look at the world and think that it's wrong and I'm right? I think that a lot of those guys that work in the finance trade, the closest thing I could compare it to is, you know, sort of legalized gambling. You know, that having passed through Vegas many times when I was a little boy, we'd drive from Utah to California to see my grandfather. I asked my father, you know, we go through, because you could feed your whole family. There were seven kids in my family, and we'd go into a casino restaurant because breakfast was 15 or 20 cents. And he'd feed the whole family, and then we'd get back in the car and leave, because that was the incentive. They'd give you cheap breakfast so that you'd go into the place and start gambling. And so after seven or eight times of over the years driving through Las Vegas, I asked my dad once, how come you never even put a nickel in a slot machine? And my dad dragged me out onto the Strip. They called it not Sunset Strip, the Strip of Las Vegas, which was one street at that time. And he dragged me out there, holding me by my ear, and he said, "You see all this? This wasn't built by winners. Now get in the car." And he kicked me in the butt, and you know, we went to Grandpa's house for Thanksgiving dinner. But that stuck with me, this idea that Las Vegas wasn't built by winners. And that kind of passion that people have for gambling, that addiction that people have for gambling, I think I don't think it's any different than what goes on down on Wall Street. I don't think that people make decisions about what's good for people. You know, if you're the head of the tobacco industry and you have to answer to your stockholders, you know, and show profit, and the profit means that there's more people that are smoking cigarettes, which is causing heart disease, which is causing cancer. How can you be that person that's the head of the tobacco industry, knowing that the increased sales is contributing to tremendous suffering of human beings that are dying from cancer and heart disease? But that's how I look at what's going on down on Wall Street. I think there's a lot of people who suffer greatly, tremendously. For a few people, a very, very small minority of people in this country who profit enormously.
Well, you did a very good job, Matthew, in universalizing with that response there. And when you mentioned you know, sociopaths, I've known some, worked with a few. When you mentioned gambling addicts, I've had three friends that have been gambling addicts to one degree or another. So these are universal concepts you're talking about. I'm sure we've all known people who fit these concepts. That seems like as good of an area as anyone to kind of segue here to another project that you've got going on. I understand that you're shopping to some film festivals here. The short film, the provocatively named short film, Jesus Was a Commie, which I can, from a surface view, I'm going to surmise that it's Old Testament teachings on social justice that you feel are not properly spotlighted in the current political sphere. But let me let you characterize it. I saw the trailer. It was a very kind of whimsical one here. You're clearly trying to make some points, so why don't you try to set it up for us?
Well, it's a very difficult film to describe. Obviously, I've given it a very provocative title, Jesus Was a Commie. But I'm not religious. I think that Jesus was an extraordinary human being. And, you know, don't think I'm being blasphemous or wanting to cause pain. I mean, that's just my opinion. But I do think he was an extraordinary teacher and a person, you know, I mean, I could compare him to other people over the history of people who have changed the way we behave and altered our consciousness, pushed us a little bit to the left. And if you look at the things that Jesus is supposed to have said and the things that he's supposed to have done, you know, by definition of what communism means in the best sense, in the utopian sense, then by definition, I think that you could say that he was communist. Of course, communism the word didn't exist when Jesus was walking the earth, but the film, in the bigger sense, addresses the tremendous challenges we face as human beings today. You know, the environmental disasters that are happening all over the world, seemingly simultaneously right now, from Japan to the Midwest to our friends in the South here that are experiencing all this tremendous flooding. The Gulf, you know, with the oil spills. I mean, we face tremendous environmental challenges right now. And what the film ultimately is saying is that these challenges are things that we have to address and face as human beings, that we can't look to a savior to save us from the problems that we face. It's up to us. It's up to each one of us as individuals to take steps. And as I say in the film, the final lines of the film is, if you do those kinds of things as well as Jesus did, you divide time. That this is a person who altered the consciousness of human beings on this planet, and there's a before him and an after him. The only other person I know who thought that he could divide time was Friedrich Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. You know, he thought that there would be before Nietzsche and after Nietzsche, or Nietzsche, however you want to pronounce his name. But obviously he didn't succeed in doing it, you know. It's a very provocative film, and I'm very, very proud of it.
It's very interesting, and from a dialoguing perspective here, as I was looking at this, and again, you know, cards on the table. I'm a free market guy, and if we were to speak of this in terms of the political spectrum, probably lining up opposite on a lot of stuff. And yet, Matthew, it comes down to me, I think, a matter of means of how to get there. I mean, I'm somebody that has a lot of distrust of centralized planning and the like, and clearly would like to see, in my own mind, some better solutions to the problems, but certainly solutions to the problems. So I don't qualify myself as a social Darwinist, and I my guess is that there's not as many as people think on that score. But regardless, in terms of advancing your point of view, what are some things you think that can be done? And I'm sure that the movie addresses this a little bit, some things to sort of get the points across better to the middle. As far as folks who look at the social safety net, in many instances, as the saying goes, in terms of being a hammock, because in some cases in the inner cities, it's been kind of a multi-generational thing here. That ultimately what it comes down to, you know, in terms of biblical passages as well, about teaching people how to fish. So what are some things you think that your political point of view can do to better address that and to let people know that your real interest is in helping people be able to fish for themselves eventually?
Well, I think it all begins with dialogue. You know, it's choosing to, you know, if we go back to the idea of he that is, or the person who's without sin, cast the first stone, was a revolutionary idea. I mean, that's a story that comes from the Old Testament, that people would be stoned to death if they committed adultery. And then you have Jesus saying that the person who's without sin cast the first stone. And he awakens this kind of responsibility of, because we all make mistakes. And that's, so to bring that to today, where we live in a society of so much gossip and magazines that sell rumor and profit from rumor, that if we just lived that ideal, that if you're without sin, go ahead and criticize another human being, that sentence has the potential to change civilization, you know, if we lived up to that simple ideal.
Well, it is very interesting in terms of trying to appeal to an idealistic point of view, and I certainly, even from my position on the spectrum, can respect that. I certainly consider myself an idealist. The one thing that I was thinking of additionally in terms of marketing for this thing, I understand the whole nature of grabbing people with a provocative title, but as somebody who growing up was aware that I had some relatives that were on the other side of the Iron Curtain, and I know that that's the case with countless numbers of Americans, the connotation of the word communist. What are your thoughts on that as far as you had talked about the notion of addressing Jesus in that way, of potentially alienating people? It's interesting because that wasn't my first thought. My first thought was people for whom communist is a foul term because of everything that happened under Stalin, relatives imprisoned for decades in Eastern Europe. What are some of your thoughts on that, and what does the movie do to try to get past that notion of it and the application of communism in people's minds?
And Lenin and even Fidel Castro.
Mm-hmm.
The film comes to a full stop when, and I say that if, now before you think that I'm attacking or condoning that kind of communism, I'm not. And the film comes to a complete stop, and it begins a dialectic about a utopian idea of communism and what communism represents. But the film by no means is advocating communism as a solution to the
Sure.
problems that we face. And make a very good, strong point of not advocating. It's what the film is a dialogue about opening people's minds up to a different way of seeing, just as though, using that stone parable again, is that if we live that parable, if we're without sin, cast the first stone. If we live that, we have the potential to change the way that we live. I grew up in Utah, and the education that I was receiving at that time was filled with fear of the yellow, I forget how they called it, the yellow threat, the yellow plague, the
peril?
Yellow peril, yeah, obviously talking about Asians and that the dangers of China taking over the world, or the threat of Russia and the Cold War. And I had the pleasure of being invited to the Berlin Film Festival in about 1982, before the wall had come down. And they invited me to go into East Berlin. And I said, I can't go into East Berlin. I'm American. I wouldn't be allowed. And they said, no, you can go into East Berlin because you are an American. And I crossed Checkpoint Charlie. I saw a monument that was built for a million Russian soldiers who had died in that area fighting the Germans. And it was extraordinary to me because I don't remember that being taught to me when I was in school, that the Russians were, in fact, our allies fighting Nazi Germany. And I met Russian soldiers, and my older brothers, particularly my older brother Mark Jr., my dad's name was Mark, had gone to Vietnam, and my brother Michael was in the Navy, and my brother Russell and my sister Elizabeth were all in the Navy. And I remember the training that they went through. And then while I was there in East Berlin, I met these Russian soldiers. And I smoked at the time, and they gave me cigarettes, and they gave me some pins from their uniforms. They spoke English, which was extraordinary to me because I couldn't, other than saying "nyet," you know, saying no in Russian, I couldn't communicate with them. But they were able to speak our language, and they were just kids. They were no different than my brothers or my sister. And that altered the way I thought about the relationships between countries, you know, the politics of the geopolitics of the world. And people are people. People want to love one another. They want to come home and be appreciated by their wives or their parents. They want to have their friendships. They want to be able to feed their families and enjoy the comforts of life. That's universal. And it's these funny things of religion and politics that are the things that separate us. And that's why if we can have that kind of open dialogue and make sure that we keep our ears open and take blinders off about perceptions of who people are, those are the steps that we need to take as human beings to evolve to a peaceful resolution to problems rather than you know, doing things like Osama bin Laden and causing tremendous suffering in the world by flying airplanes into buildings. That's not the solution to the problems we face, you know. Mm-hmm. And people that throw stones aren't throwing stones because of a God told them to do it. They're throwing stones and because they're idiots, you know. And that's not how you solve the problem.
Yeah,
you know, it's not like I watched, you know, out of frustration. I'm an NBA fan, and seeing Bynum throw that elbow into the Dallas, Texas player at the end of the game out of frustration because he lost the game. That's the kind of behavior that you know, he was thrown out of the game, and that's how it should be taken care of. We don't play the game with people who throw elbows into people out of frustration. Especially when they're in a vulnerable position.
Very well said, Matthew. By the way, when you mentioned basketball, that triggered a memory here. One of our cast members, one of our contributors to the show who knew you were coming on tonight, Kyle Ross, texted me today, and this is a question without any context whatsoever. Ask him why he was so hyped in the front row of that WNBA game. So no context to that whatsoever, Matthew. Do you have any idea what he might have been talking about?
No, I don't know what he's talking about. But you know what? The women's basketball is really fun. And I hope that it can continue to grow and get more fans, because it's a men's sport, and traditionally, I guess we could say, but the women play it with such passion and fervor that it's a different game, obviously, than the way the men play. But you know, at Madison Square Garden, there might be half the fans at a WNBA game than at a NBA game, but the girls in the audience are twice as loud and twice as passionate.
Yeah,
it's really fun. It's really fun.
The fans that are there certainly are passionate. Well, great stuff tonight, Matthew. Again, we really there's so much we didn't even get a chance to hit here in this slot, so much TV and movie and stage work additionally. But if there's anything else that we didn't hit that we should have or we need to hit more substantially, please take it away.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you talking about the Full Metal Jacket Diary app and Kickstarter. I met the man who owns Kickstarter. His name's Yancey. I think that what he's providing for people, giving young artists, young musicians, the opportunity to raise money for projects. I think now that they've raised I want to say $50 million for all kinds of different artistic endeavors that young people across the United States, not young and old, that trying to and so people invest in the projects because they want to see them fulfilled, you know. So it's a wonderfully democratic kind of artistic website, you know, Kickstarter. And if there's musicians listening, if there's painters that's listening, photographers, filmmakers, I encourage you to find out more about Kickstarter and to look at the Full Metal Jacket diary information there. You know, Too Big to Fail, I haven't seen it. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. And you know, if the listeners, just to tease them, I'm getting ready to start a movie. I won't tell you what it is because I'm not allowed to, but I'll just say that it's part of a billion-dollar franchise, and I'll just let them speculate as to what that might be.
Interesting. All right, we're putting it out there for people tonight. As you mentioned, Full Metal Jacket Diary MatthewModine.com, MatthewModine.com, and at Kickstarter.com, and there are links to that there. Your project is available there for people to participate and help bring it to fruition. Matthew, thank you so much. These are the kind of conversations we really enjoy having on this show. True pleasure, sir. We'd love to have you back in sometime.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks very much. Matthew Modine, everybody, actor, director,